part of the deal will be that Donetsk and Luhansk will have a measure of autonomy within the Ukrainian state. Now, that never happened. Zelensky had said it was going to happen, but he was not allowed to let it happen if indeed he wanted it to happen. Not allowed by the neo-Nazis, not allowed, I suspect, by the United States. So the Minsk Accords never were implemented. The fly in the ointment was Ukraine, and that's the background to all this. And it was when Minsk really sort of fell apart, the Russian invasion of Ukraine was provoked.
That's Ray McGovern, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Ray McGovern on the hidden history of U.S.-Ukraine-Russia relations. The February 24th Russian invasion of Ukraine has rattled the world and has unleashed misery, death, and destruction. What prompted Moscow's attack? From their perspective, the expansion of NATO, a U.S.-led military alliance, up to Russia's borders, threatens their national security interests. It went against assurances given by Washington that that would not happen. Years ago, George Kennan, the much-revered and venerated State Department diplomat, warned against NATO expansion. With great foresight, he said, "It would be the most fateful error of American policy in the entire post-Cold War era. Such a decision may be expected to inflame the nationalistic, anti-Western, and militaristic tendencies in Russian opinion, to have an adverse effect on the development of Russian democracy, to restore the atmosphere of the Cold War to East-West relations, and to impel Russian foreign policy in directions decidedly not to our liking." To talk about the hidden history of U.S.-Ukraine-Russia relations is Ray McGovern. He's a former Central Intelligence Agency officer. He was a CIA analyst from 1963 to 1990. In the 1980s, he chaired National Intelligence Estimates and prepared the president's daily brief. Today, he's active in the peace and justice movement. He works with Tell the Word, a ministry of the inner city Washington, D.C. Church of the Savior. He spoke in Raleigh, North Carolina on April 19th. And now, Ray McGovern.
Where are we on Ukraine? Try to be brief here, but it's necessary to go back to 1989 when the Berlin Wall fell. Eastern Europe was falling apart. George H.W. Bush, to his credit, called up Mikhail Gorbachev and said, "Mikhail, sorry about all your troubles, but I assure you, I'm not going to dance on the Berlin Wall." His words. "We're not going to take advantage of your problems in Eastern Europe. We need to meet because the place is falling apart. How soon can you meet me in a summit?" And Gorbachev said, "A couple of weeks." "Okay," says Bush, "meet me in Malta, first week of December." And that's what they did. And Bush told him, "Look, you need to see my Secretary of State, James Baker. How soon can you see him?" "4 weeks." "Okay." 1st of February, 1990 now, you have Baker arrive in Moscow. So what does he say? He says, "Mikhail, we got a deal for you. What we'd like is a reunited Germany." Now, when I heard that they were discussing a reunited Germany, I didn't want a reunited Germany. I knew that NATO was set up to keep the U.S. in, to keep Russia out, and to keep Germany divided. And so now I extrapolate from that, and I try to put myself in the position of Gorbachev, or Shevardnadze, his foreign minister. Now, they're Russian, right? Putin lost his big brother, siege of Leningrad. His father was wounded. His mother was left for dead, but luckily somebody heard her whimper. Russia lost 26 million citizens, Soviet citizens, during World War II. By comparison, the U.S. had 400,000 combat troops killed. Now, that's a lot of troops. 400,000 is a lot. 26 million is a lot more. Where did the Nazis come through? Ukraine. Where did Napoleon come to? Well, Ukraine. So, you know, here they're being asked to say, well, wait a second, we're going to reunite Germany. And so their answer was, well, all right, that's your quid. That's what you want. What's your quo? What's the quo that we'll get? And Baker said, well, how would it be? And I have this from Jack Matlock, Ambassador Matlock, who was there, okay? How would it be if we promised not to move any NATO troops, any NATO countries, 1 inch? That's about 2.5 centimeters, said Michel, closer to Russia. Wow. Okay, the place was falling apart. Gorbachev and Shevardnadze were in real need of U.S. economic aid. They said, well, we'll cut the steel. Okay, you promise, right? Cross my heart and hope to die, says James Baker. Now, my father was a lawyer. He always used to say, Ray, get it in writing. Get it in writing, right? Now, James Baker's a lawyer, the real slick lawyer. And since Gorbachev and Shevardnadze didn't have the presence of mind to say, hey, we need that in writing, they didn't get it in writing. So when Bill Clinton came in, 1996, 1997, he said, show me that promise in writing. It wasn't in writing. And so Bill Clinton said, well, easy. We'll just let Poland and Hungary and Czech Republic, let them in. And everybody said, well, we promised not to. Jack Matlock testified before the Congressional Committee, said, no, we promised not to. This is going to lead to all kinds of problems if you let these guys in. But then Jack was told after he testified, look, Clinton's already decided that he needs the Czech, the Polish, the Hungarian vote in the Midwest. So it's a done deal. Doesn't matter if you think it's strategically crazy. Forget about it. Roll with the punches. Matlock, he said that. He's actually written that. And so, long story short, we went back on our promise not to move NATO 1 inch to the east of the East German border at the time. Now count them up, 14 new nations in NATO since that promise. So let's fast forward now to 2008. What happened? Well, people are talking about adding Ukraine and Georgia, the country of Georgia in the Caucasus, to NATO. Now, at this time, Putin had pretty much started rebuilding the Russian military. He's trying to be a little bit more assertive. And so he told his foreign minister, then as now, Sergei Lavrov, said, you call the U.S. ambassador in and tell him, yet. Yet for what? Yet. You don't let Ukraine into NATO. So that's what happens. I have to tell you that we have a Moscow cable that spells all this out, because it's the cable from the U.S. ambassador in Moscow at the time. His name was William Burns, okay? Right now he's the head of CIA of all places. Anyhow, he's called in by Lavrov, and Lavrov says, Mr. Burns, do you know what net means? Well, net means net. You don't let Ukraine or Georgia into NATO, because if that happens, we will have to decide whether we have to invade. Then we have to decide what we do about a civil war that will inevitably arise. We don't want to face that. We have geopolitical interests here. Net means net. How do I know all this? It's from a Moscow cable. How do we get the Moscow cable? From Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, okay? It's just one gem that is in that all that take from Julian Assange. How do I know it's authentic? I've seen one Moscow cable from the embassy in Moscow. I've seen about 5,000 over my career. So There you have. And to his credit, Ambassador Burns at the time played it straight. He said to Condoleezza Rice, who was Secretary of State at the time, he said, look, Russia does have its own strategic concerns. It's reasonable to think that they are, genuinely concerned about their, blah, 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 blah. Well, ambassadors usually don't go that far against the tide. So Bill Burns did. And what did Condoleezza Rice do? Well, she talked to Dick Cheney and she talked to George Bush. And they said, screw the Russians. At the next NATO meeting, let's pressure everyone to admit them into NATO, Ukraine and Georgia. So 2 months later, in Bucharest at a NATO summit, the declaration said Ukraine and Georgia will become members of NATO. So that's 2008. What did the Russians do about it? Well, they knew enough about how the French and Germans really felt about Ukraine and Georgia coming into NATO. They knew that was not going to happen anytime soon, okay? So let's fast forward from 2008 to more recent times. Okay, well, let's talk about what Biden did when he came in, because that will get us up to date. The first thing he did, which was relevant to Russia, was let himself be snuckered into answering a question from George Stephanopoulos. Stephanopoulos says, Mr. President, do you think Putin's a killer? And Biden said, I think he's a killer. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Now, remember that was March the 17th. So what happened next? Well, next week, Jake Sullivan and Tony Blinken go out to Anchorage to meet their Chinese counterparts. And they talk to them as though they were the British imperialists. The Chinese have such a sad history dealing with it. Okay? They talk down to them. It was so bad that the Chinese foreign minister said, look, you don't have the qualifications to talk to us stuff like that. So the two sort of major insults at pretty much the same time. What happens? Now, we're talking the end of March last year. Now, on the 24th of March, the president of Ukraine, Zelensky, says out of the blue, we're going to take back Crimea. We're going to take back the eastern provinces. And, if it comes to having a war about that, we're good for that. We're good for the battle. He made that the policy of the Ukrainian government. What happens the next day? March 25th, the Russians send tens of thousands of troops to the border area near Ukraine. Next thing you know, President Biden gets a little upset about what Zelensky has said and how the Russians have reacted. Then Biden says, hey, let's have a summit to discuss all this. And Putin says, okay, sure, all right. So on the 16th of June, if you fast forward now, they have this summit. And it didn't go really well. And one of the reasons it didn't go really well was because Biden, as he indicated before they could hustle onto the plane, he told the press, it's not really appropriate for me to say what I'm going to say. Putin has a major problem, and it's China. They're squeezing the Russians, Biden's word, squeezing Russia. They have this long, long border. And China, of course, wants to be the paramount military presence there in Asia. They have a real serious problem with China. Now, I would have loved to have been with Putin and his advisors when Putin turned to them and says, where does Biden get the idea that China and Russia are each other's throats? That was the case five decades ago. Are these young advisors that he had, are they reading out of a textbook that goes back five decades? We have to show this president that China and we, Russia, are really allied now. And that far from we having a problem with China, China is going to support us in whatever else we do. So what happens? They do all kinds of PR things, including a direct telephone call between Putin and Xi, the president of China, in which they show that they're very solid in their mutual aims. Xi comments that, well, this is the 27th meeting we've had, either virtual or in person, since 2013. So they went out of their way to show that China and Russia are united in facing down what they consider to be the common threat from US. So where does this get us now? When Putin and Xi were on the telephone, it was the middle of December, Putin said, look, I'm coming to the Olympics. And Xi said, you're most welcome. So Putin was up there on the 4th of February when the Olympics started. Now, right before that, in the 8 or 9 weeks before that, there was this back and forth about, well, you know, meeting Russia's security concerns. Could they work out a deal so that Russia wouldn't be so afraid of what the US and NATO were doing right on its long border with Ukraine? So Putin had a chance to discuss this with Xi. Now, this is speculation with respect to exactly how it went down, but I think in retrospect, this is the way it happened. Putin says to Xi, look, best friend Xi, NATO and the Americans are not taking us seriously. We have information that whatever they promise is not going to last. You know, new president comes in and reverses everything. So we're going to have to take care of the Nazis. We're going to have to take care of the very highly militarized and now trained by NATO forces in Ukraine. And this is the point we're going to have to do it before they attack us. We have information that they're arrayed against Donetsk and Luhansk, ready to strike, say, in early March. So we may have to go and invade Ukraine. Z, you mean after the Olympics, right? Putin, yes, after the Olympics. Now, that's big, okay? All my Chinese analyst friends said Z would never approve that. China has this fundamental foreign policy principle stand against interference in the affairs of other countries. That would never square with that. Well, guess what? In my view, Xi gave Putin an exemption. He kind of said, and he has said two times now to EU leaders and to others, he said, hey, to Biden, he said, look, we judge things on the facts on the ground, whatever each specific circumstances is. He didn't say this, but usually they said, no, that's a principle stand. We're against interference in any other country. So the way I see this going down is that Xi himself threatened by the US. I don't know if you know this, but the Defense Department has come out with its every 4 year national strategy document. And guess who's enemy number one? China. Guess who doesn't even make it to the top four enemies? Russia. So they've trained their sights on China. And Xi has read that document, I'm sure. And so it's kind of a deal where he knows that if Russia falters in the West, he's next in line, let's put it that way. So what do we have right now? Right now, we've got a very, very dangerous situation. Russia has said that it's going to denazify and demilitarize Ukraine. Now, the Nazis are in Mariupol. That's the whole deal about Mariupol. The Azov Battalion and many of the Nazi-led and Nazi-populated units are encircled down there in Mariupol. The Russians can just bomb them now, or they can wait until they come out. One of the reasons why it's very delicate is that as they come out, you may see some contractors from Western Europe or from the United States advising, in some cases, perhaps even leading some of these Nazi battalions. That's going to be very, very, very embarrassing. So what's going on now is the U.S. is trying to appear very strong. Biden has been told, look, Democrats are going to really take it on the nose in November unless you appear strong. And everybody, especially the media, is sort of saying, well, you can't just let the Russians win. Well, here's the bottom line. The Russians have to win. For Russia, what's been going on in Ukraine is an existential threat. And as I mentioned, the Russians told us this back on February 1st, 2008. We have the cable. What I'm saying is this, that Putin has got 80% approval rating so far. It looks like he's got an existential threat that he sees. And so for him, it's a must win. Now, how about the U.S.? What's going to happen when it becomes widely known that all these taxpayer dollars going into $800 million more, there are $3 billion all told, arms worth going to Ukraine, get blown up? I mean, that's not going to look strong at all. What I'm saying here is this. The U.S. continues to pour in all these weaponry, and the Russians said, we're going to destroy it if you put it in there. Unintended consequences. I mean, really clear as a bell what the consequences are going to be. The dilemma is the U.S. and NATO don't need to win this one, in my view. They only need to win this one if you accept the sophomoric view that Putin wants to take over all of Europe. Now, I'm not kidding. This is a view espoused by Fiona Hill, the go-to lady. She says, yep, that's what Putin's aim is, to chase the U.S. out of Europe and, as she delicately put it, not let NATO's door or U.S. door hit their backside as they leave. Well, you know, there is no evidence. And John Mearsheimer, who knows a lot more about foreign relations than I do, agrees. There's no evidence that Putin wants to take over the rest of the world. There's no evidence that Putin wants to take over Germany or France or any part of Western Europe. That's passé. There's no evidence for that. So unless the U.S. wants to back Putin in the kind of corner where he has to think about, not just talk about, using nuclear weapons. And I do give Biden credit for doing everything he can to foreclose the option of World War III here. And, you know, the midterms are really important to the Dems. You know, the Dems don't want to look weak. Unless he can fence down these pressures, which come from everybody except, ironically, the Pentagon. The Pentagon knows which end is up here. They know that China and Russia are pretty much united in the military alliance now. Bottom line here, Putin has to win. If he's driven into a corner where it looks like he can't win, what's going to happen? China, like the cavalry, to the rescue. Now, they don't have to pour troops into Ukraine, for God's sake. They can just do a little dust up right there in the South China Sea or, of course, from Taiwan. And our U.S. Navy would be delighted because that means they'll get more money for build twice as many ships. But it's going to worry the planners that have to say, oh, wait a second now, are we ready for a two-front war? And that's why the Pentagon has been much more reluctant, much more judicious in facing up to this threat. So I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ray. That's very interesting. And I know there will be questions.
You mentioned a lot of Nazis in Mariupol, and I wonder what the definition of Nazi is.
Well, all I would say is that these are people who take as their banner patriot, Stepan Bandera, who cooperated with the Nazis, actually. He fought under the Nazis during World War II. These are people who really liquidated many Poles, many Hungarians, many Ukrainians at the behest of Hitler. That's because they hated the Russians more than they hated the Germans. Now, their direct descendants who use swastikas on their flags and who, you know, Sieg Heil sort of salute, it's well known that they were the spearhead of the revolution. It's called a revolution. It was a coup d'etat on the Maidan in Kiev on February 22nd, 2014. They led that. Now, who trained them? Well, Western intelligence services trained and equipped them. We know that. They were shooting at the police as well as the demonstrators on the Maidan. And it was, you know, it was a deliberate provocation to have the coup. When the new government was formed, there were Nazis in prominent positions in the security services and so forth. When Zelensky was elected president, he had hopes of tamping down tensions with Russia. In fact, that most people think that's largely why he won. So he went out to the Donetsk and Lugansk, where Nazi neo-Nazis, maybe that's a little better. Okay, they're out there, and he says to them, look, could you ease off on the shelling? We've already had 14,000 people killed. Could you ease off a little? And they looked at him and said, well, who the hell are you? I said, I'm the president. I'm the president. I'm ordering you. And say, get out of here. Now, that's how much power Zelensky has over these folks who really have been wreaking havoc against Russian speakers, many of them Russian citizens in Donetsk and Lugansk. And that was part, I believe, of the motivation where Putin and his advisors said, you know, look, if we don't stop this carnage, and if, as we think, the Ukrainians are about to go in there and take over Donetsk and Lugansk, if we don't do it now, when will we ever do it? So 8 years is a long time. And the business about Zelensky being of Jewish descent, well, that's just a really good talking point. He's not his own man. He has to answer to the Nazis as well as to the United States.
You hear people talk about the United States and China getting together to do a negotiated settlement. What kind of things need to happen for that to take place?
Well, I don't think the Chinese are going to be able to play any kind of middleman role. But since they've thrown their support right behind Russia, it doesn't seem like anyone would want to deal with the Chinese as an interlocutor. What needs to happen, what I dearly hope happens, is a ceasefire as soon as possible. But the way things are going, it looks like the Russians mean to do their thing there in the southern part, there in the Mariupol, where they have encircled most of these Ukrainian and many of them Nazi-led units. This rings a bell. The Nazis did come through Ukraine. The Nazis did kill 26 million Soviet citizens. And so when Russians see atrocities caused by the regiment there, the folks that actually became part of the government, the right sector, the Azov Battalion, that gets publicized in Russia. And there's a good deal of internal support for cleaning them out now so that they don't kill 14,000 more Russian speakers or Russian citizens in Donetsk and Lugansk. What needs to happen also is that a recognition that Ukraine could become neutral. A couple of weeks ago, Zelensky said, okay, we don't have to join NATO. He may have even said, yeah, we could remain neutral. Well, that's a big concession. That means not a member of NATO. So what happened? Well, nobody seemed to think that was good enough. And in my view, He's faced a lot of pressure, not only from the Nazis, the neo-Nazis, but also from Washington. There's every reason to suspect that Washington is prepared to let this go, fighting off to the last Ukrainian. They're shipping in more arms. Is that a way to get a negotiated settlement? I don't think so. Biden is calling Putin every name in the book. Is that a way to get negotiated? I don't think so. And not only that, but people like Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, is saying openly that our objective is to weaken Russia and make sure that Russia is not a big player.
You're listening to Ray McGovern, The Hidden History of U.S.-Ukraine-Russia Relations. This is Independent Alternative Radio.
Now, the sanctions hurt. They hurt everybody. I mean, they're hurting people right here. They'll hurt China a little bit, but the Russians are kind of used to dealing with sanctions now, and they're making all kinds of arrangements, and I'm not an economist, but I will say this. I have no more confidence in the economists advising Biden than I do in the Jake Sullivans and the Tony Blinkens and the other sophomores who have very little experience and operate out of a imperialist kind of hubris. You know, when I was watching Sino-Soviet relations, they used to call each other imperialists, but they also call each other great power chauvinists, okay? Well, if you look at some of the rhetoric coming out of Washington, people still think that the U.S. is exceptional, that it's indispensable. And that's great power chauvinism. And the ironic thing is that that was true once upon a time, after World War II, and even after 1989, when the Berlin Wall fell down. It's not true any longer. Worse still, from the U.S. point of view, you have the other two major powers, Russia and China, and you have people, you have countries like India, South Africa, Brazil, Saudi Arabia, lots of people. And their distinctive mark, by the way, is they don't look like us. Now, Russians have been so blackened that they don't look like us either by now. But what I'm trying to say here is that racism plays a real role, in my view, and that it's much easier to take on people of color, as we have, you count on Vietnam, Afghanistan, or whatever. It's much easier to do that. And it's much harder to take in refugees from these countries. Look what's happening in Ukraine. They're being welcomed with open arms by Poland. Poland wouldn't take one Syrian, for God's sake. So racism is playing a role here. And as long as our policymakers, some of them very ivy clad in their outlooks, consider themselves to be above others, we're in for a real shocking realization. That's no longer the case. And to proceed on those assumptions is going to get us a very bloody nose at the hands not only of Russia, but of China.
Here's another question. Why is it that there's so little accurate detail in U.S. media sources?
Well, the media is controlled by the rest of what I call the Mickey Mat. Eisenhower, of course, warned about the accretion of influence by the hands of the MIC, the military-industrial complex. Today, we have something much more involved. It's developed like Topsy. Okay, now it's the Mickey Mat. It's the military, industrial, congressional, intelligence, media, academia, think tank complex. Now, why did I say media? Because media is the linchpin. Doesn't work without the media. Who owns the media? The rest of the Mickey Mat, okay? So media is part of this profiteering on war. We have Raytheon and Lockheed sending letters out to their shareholders a couple months ago saying, uptick in tensions in Ukraine, very good for business. Raytheon makes the missiles And so Lockheed makes just about everything else. Boeing, they're all in it, and they're all profiteering on this. And so, in short, the media being controlled by these same corporations is only going to give you one side of the story. That's why probably some of the things I've said tonight have been offensive to you, because they're so new. It's very difficult to break into the mainstream media. We have to keep trying. Another thing that I have in mind is we have to get out and put our bodies into it in whatever way that we think we can do that. Used to be that we could get out and demonstrate or visit our congresspeople. Hopefully the COVID scare will diminish and we'll be able to do more of that. But unless people see how acute the problem is, unless people see that, you know, we've been sold a bill of goods just as we were before Iraq, just as we were during Russiagate, unless they can see that, then it's hard for them to act. We got some initial press when we opposed the war in Iraq for being not grounded in any reality that is evidence of weapons of mass destruction. Ex post facto, we'll be able to say, well, you know, this was a bunch of lies, but ex post facto doesn't count. The risks are very, very, very high this time, the more so since something I didn't mention, but should be of interest. Ted Postol, who is a MIT professor of physics and who is the chief intelligence advisor for the chief of naval operations in the Pentagon, he has found that Russia's early warning system of incoming attack is woefully deficient. It's about a quarter as good as ours. Now, let me explain to the degree I can. We have these really sophisticated satellites. This is no classified thing. It's well known that our satellites cover the world. Any ballistic missile that's fired, whether it's on the sea, under the sea, on land, we see it immediately, okay? Not so the Russians. And Ted likes to cite a case study where a rocket went up from the northern part of Norway. It was a research rocket. They want to find out something about the Milky Way or something, right? But no one told the Russians. And as it vectored into the space where the Russians are looking right down at North Dakota and where all our missiles are, there was a threat that was incoming, okay? That could have been the beginning of a nuclear attack on Russia. So Ted explains that these generals and admirals, they're in the situation room. They don't know what to make of this. And say, well, check on the ICBMs. They checked on the ICBMs. No particular activity at the ICBM fields in North Dakota, Colorado, well, Montana, okay? Whew. Well, how about the North Atlantic? Well, sir, you know we can't cover the North Atlantic. That's the reality, folks. The Russians can't know if we send off these Trident, these missiles on the Trident submarines, they don't have coverage of the seas. So what am I talking about now? I'm talking about back in the day, in my day, let's say the 70s, 80s, there would be about 35 minutes of warning time from launch to target. So a president, President Putin now, or President Biden, would have half of that at least, if it was verified, to decide what to do, whether they should destroy the rest of the world at the same time or not. Now, it's not that way. And the danger that Putin has spoken about for 7 years now, these sites that are going into Poland and Romania, the one in Romania is finished, the ones in Poland is being finished, they're described as anti-ballistic missile sites, but all you have to do is put a CD in their computer and they turn out to be able to fire Tomahawk missiles. They can hit Moscow and they can hit the ICBM force in the western part of Russia in about 6 or 7 minutes. If these same sites are equipped with hypersonic missiles, it's like 4 to 5 minutes. Now, that's not enough. That's not enough for Putin to decide whether to destroy the rest of the world. So he's got a legitimate concern there. And he knows that these ABM sites set up ostensibly to guard against ICBMs from Iran. So he knows that that was a lie, that that's why they were constructed. So the ABM treaty, George Bush destroyed. The Intermediate Forces Treaty, Trump got rid of that one. So the Russians are facing this existential, and I say that again, existential threat from a NATO and the United States that doesn't take their security concerns seriously. And were those sites to be peopled by different missiles, Tomahawk missiles or these hypersonic missiles, there's no warning time. So what's the result? Well, you know what the result is, don't you? They automate the process. So the next time you have a research scientific missile going up in northern Norway, well, do subordinate units now have the authorization to press the nuclear button? Well, the alternative is be too late for Putin to push it. Now, I don't know what the real situation is, but that is really, really dangerous. The circumstances that I described are real. And Ted Postel and other people who know a lot more about the missilery and the launching and the coverage by our satellites and the lack of coverage by Russian satellites. So, you know, what we're talking about here is existential threats. Now, the other thing is, and this I'll leave with you, economists talk about opportunity costs. You build one aircraft and you could have built schools for a whole state for what that aircraft costs. Okay. Now, the mother of all opportunity costs, get this, the mother of all opportunity costs is Ukraine. The reason I say that is if we don't have a lot of time to deal with global warming. All our attention is diverted from that now. The Chinese are digging more coal than before. The U.S. military is the greatest provider, the worst provider of those fumes that go up and destroy our stratosphere. So the mother of all opportunity costs is what Ukraine has really done to the longer term. And you don't have to have 10 grandchildren as we do to worry a little bit about what happens to the next generation and then the generation after that. If these wars and other things that aggravate the situation not ended quickly.
First, let me thank you, Ray. This has been really good. And I think your last point about opportunity costs, it may be a basic point, but you put it very powerfully. So thank you. This is in a way less important than that, but I would love it if you would backtrack to 2014 in Ukraine. And I'd like to hear your comments on that and your comments on the Minsk agreements.
I sort of glided over that and it deserved more attention. I'm going to go back to 2013 because this gave a real push to the putsch that happened in 2014. What I mean is this, the neocons who are back now helping Biden run foreign policy wanted to have a war in Syria. And so what happened was there was a false flag chemical attack outside of Damascus, which they blamed on Bashar al-Assad. That was on the 21st of August, 2013. John Kerry got up a week later and said, Bashar al-Assad did it. He said that 35 times in one speech. Did Bashar al-Assad do it? No, he didn't. The head of national intelligence visited President Obama at the same time and said, look, Kerry's a great guy, but he's misinformed. We can't give you an intelligence estimate. Now, at the same time, Obama was going to St. Petersburg for an economic summit, group of eight, I think, at the time. And so he met with Putin. And Putin said, hey, Mr. President, I have a way out of your problem. Let me just tell you, we've persuaded the Syrians to destroy all their chemical weapons on a U.S. ship outfitted for such destruction under U.N. supervision. That would avoid your problem. You wouldn't have to make a war on Syria. What do you think? Well, Obama didn't have to think very long. He said, man, that'd be great. Okay. Now, while Kerry kept pushing for a war against Syria, Obama came back and said, look, John Kerry, we're not going to go to war with Syria. Work out this deal at Geneva. And long story short, those Syrian chemical weapons were destroyed under UN supervision on a US warship. Okay. Now, Putin wrote an op-ed on September 11, 2013. And he said, you know, I'm really, really happy at the growth of mutual trust, not only between our countries, but between Mr. Obama and me personally. I hope it will grow. We've avoided a war. The only thing I object to is the notion that one country is more exceptional than the others. Okay. So that was a New York Times op-ed written by Putin. Okay. So growth of trust, that's verboten. That's, you can't have growth of trust and make a lot of money for Raytheon and for Lockheed. That's for the birds. Okay. So what happens? The people in the State Department, Victoria Nuland and the others, tell the CIA guys and all to train up those rightists, those neo-Nazis in Poland and elsewhere. And we're going to have a putsch. We're going to have a putsch on the middle of Kiev. And we're going to change the government because the government there now under Yanukovych is a little bit too pro-Russian. And so that's what they do. 6 months after the growth of trust, they do a coup in Kiev, the capital of Ukraine, on the 22nd of February, 2014. Now, why is that coup appropriately called the most blatant coup in history? Because the intercepted conversation between our Assistant Secretary of State, Victoria Nuland, and our ambassador in Kiev, Jeffrey Pyatt, they're plotting the coup. They're saying who will be the next prime minister, Yats for Yatsenyuk. They're saying, you know, the EU doesn't like it, F the EU. They're saying, you know, we need some international personage to solidify this. Jake Sullivan, who works for Vice President Biden, says Biden is good to come in and make this thing stick. Okay. Now, what's extraordinary about that? Two things. Number one, they said that en clair, no encryption in this telephone conversation. Somebody intercepted it. And number two, it was put on YouTube. Oh, when was it put on YouTube? On the 4th of February, 2014. Oh, 4th of February. Well, you said the coup was the 22nd, but that was blown. Yeah, it was blown. When I heard that thing on YouTube, I said, well, poor Yatsenyuk, he'll never be prime minister of Ukraine. And, my God, Victoria Nuland using that language? F the EU? One reason we know it's authentic is because Nuland apologized 2 days later. Not for the coup, but for saying F the EU. Okay. So long story short, 18 days before the coup, it was advertised on YouTube. Now what happened? Well, the coup plotters were able to dislodge those people who were loyal to the government. I guess Putin thought the same thing I did. The coup is blown. Too bad for Yatsenyuk. I can stay in Sochi and finish up these Winter Olympics. They didn't come back until the day later, the 23rd of February 2014. Now, what did he do? Oh, my God. The new prime minister of Ukraine said that he'd like Ukraine to join, guess what, join NATO. He'd like to ban Russian as an official language in Ukraine. He said this right away. So Putin's with his advisors there, his military advisors, what can you do about this? Can we countenance a Ukraine in NATO? And the answer was, Нет. Okay. And the people in the Russian-speaking provinces of Donetsk and Lugansk in the east part of Ukraine, they didn't want any part of the coup government banning Russian as an official language and all kinds of other indignities that the people there in the coup regime were doing on pro-Russians and Russians. So they decided that they would resist the encroachment of the coup regime. And so they declared their independence. I'm glad you mentioned the Minsk protocols, because we're talking 2014, February. What happened was the Ukrainian army geared itself up and went out to take back Donetsk and Lugansk. They were fought to a standstill. It was really, really bloody. Most of those 14,000 people killed were killed then. And people with more sense said, well, let's stop this. And the Germans and the French and the Polish at the time put the strong arm around the Ukrainian sides and said, look, stop the fighting. We'll have a ceasefire and then we'll talk. And part of the deal will be that Donetsk and Luhansk will have a measure of autonomy within the Ukrainian state, but that will be written into the constitution. Now, that never happened. Zelensky had said it was going to happen, but he was not allowed to let it happen if indeed he wanted it to happen. Not allowed by the neo-Nazis, not allowed, I suspect, by the United States. So the Minsk Accords, as much as they tried to tamp down the situation and were endorsed at the highest level of the United Nations, mind you, they never were implemented. The fly in the ointment was Ukraine. The motivation was clear. They didn't want any part of that. And that's the background to all this. And it was when Minsk really sort of fell apart, when Putin decided, well, we need to finish this thing off. It's not going to be very legal, but we're going to do it. Last thing I'll say on that, it's not very legal. There are some folks that say, well, you could explain it. Certainly it's as legal as some of the things the U.S. did. The other adjective used was unprovoked. It was provoked. The Russian invasion of Ukraine was provoked. Putin, in my view, is looking out for the national security of his country, does not want to be threatened in the same way that the U.S. felt threatened during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Think about it. Soviet missiles right up there next to Florida. That was an existential threat to us. We faced Khrushchev down. We were able to work out a deal or even move some missiles from Turkey, but we had the sense to avoid the worst. Now, what does Biden have? My God, it sends sweat up the back of my neck here. He's got no expertise that has any real depth to it. And so I'm afraid that unless the military is able to prevail as it has so far and say, look, Mr. Biden, we're not prepared for a two-front war with China getting in this thing. These hotheads, Blinken, Sullivan, and the others, I just wish better for Biden, because I think he's got enough experience to know how dangerous it would be to provoke Putin into being in such a corner that he might actually think of using small nuclear weapons. Again, I'm talking too much, but I hope that helps. Thanks all.
You were just listening to Ray McGovern, The Hidden History of U.S.-Ukraine-Russia Relations. He spoke in Raleigh, North Carolina on April 19th. Ray McGovern is a former Central Intelligence Agency officer. He was a CIA analyst from 1963 to 1990. Today, he's active in the peace and justice movement. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are an independent nonprofit in our 36th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Katrina Vandenhoevel, Noam Chomsky, Chris Hedges, and Vandana Shiva. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. We're offering printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program at no charge. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Jerry Markatos and North Carolina Peace Action. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.